From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those special open lines, Friday night and the Saturday morning. Here's what's happening. Of course, you know, last night I was talking to Dr. Tim Ball about what's going on with the climate. Listen to this one. Antarctica's ozone hole is finally starting to heal, according to a new study. Research from the United States and the United Kingdom shows that the ozone hole is getting smaller and forming later in the year, and that the study in the journal Science also shows other indications that the ozone layer is improving after it was being eaten away by chemicals and aerosols and refrigerants. Ozone is a combination of three oxygen atoms. High in the atmosphere, it shields Earth from ultraviolet rays. That's good news. Now, you remember when Mom used to make cookies out of dough and we'd eat the raw dough right off the spoon? Don't do that. In a warning that's sure to disappoint many who enjoy sneaking a taste of cookie dough, federal regulators said this week that people should not eat raw dough or batter of any kind due to an outgoing outbreak of illness related to a strain of E. coli bacteria found in some recalled flour. Our food safety coach, Jeff Nelkin, with us. Jeff, now, when we were kids, we used to eat it all the time. I don't remember getting sick from this.
Myself included, but, you know, they started finding out that, you know, the raw eggs, you know, in the product, you know, was the trigger back then. Today's situation is related to that General Mills outbreak, and anyone that has the flour from General Mills and they're not sure if the flour is involved in the recall, please call General Mills. They have a consumer number, 800-230-8103, and then this way you can check and make sure that the flour that you have is not involved. In fact, some of the restaurants have been using flour and water for children to play with.
Like almost like putty and glue.
Exactly. And then the kids start putting the fingers in their mouth, and that's how they were, you know, getting, the contaminated flour. So they stopped doing that as well.
It's so tempting, though, to eat the batter off the spoon, Jeff, isn't it?
Right. But, you know, one can pay a price. And especially for those people that are high-risk individuals, you certainly want to be careful. But unless you're using pasteurized eggs, it's a different story. But if you're using eggs that are not pasteurized, you know, it's something we need to stay away from.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much. Jeff Nelkin, food safety coach. The Federal Bureau of Investigation considered creating an alert system 7 years ago to tip off agents to multiple gun purchases, like those made by the Orlando, Florida nightclub gunman, but abandoned the idea over legal concerns, according to multiple officials. The law enforcement officials who study mass shooters say that multiple firearm purchases can be a key indicator that a troubled individual is taking concrete steps toward violence, much like the Orlando shooter Omar Mateen, who bought a handgun and a rifle in the days before he killed 49 people. I would think a red flag would be if they bought more than just a handgun and a rifle, but that according to this study. Commandos backed by armored vehicles stormed an upscale restaurant in Bangladesh's capital. It is still going on right now. 5 to 6 militants have been killed. 12 people have been released and rescued so far from the restaurant. More sickies and ISIS apparently claiming responsibility for that situation. A Hindu priest has been hacked to death at his temple in Bangladesh's southwestern district. It's the latest incident there in a wave of suspected religious-based murders, despite a nationwide crackdown by the government there. Police say a central Pennsylvania man beat his friend for refusing to eat some ramen noodles. What is going on with people? He punched him in the eye 10 to 15 times. The victim had bruises, swelling, and a 1-inch cut under his eye. People are just getting whacked out. You know, the guy from Pittsburgh gives us commentary once a month on stories that really affect people and stories that catch his eye. He's concerned about whacked out people. Listen in.
How you doing? This is George Senda, the guy from Pittsburgh, and I asked the question, are there more crazies out there than there used to be? I think so. I see them at the bus stop, I see them on the bus, at supermarkets and shopping malls. Some of you probably have them at work and may even have them in your own family. The Huffington Post says there are 60 million mentally ill people in this country. And what do we do about it? Nothing. What do our legislators do about it? Nothing. Instead, they fund useless programs or build fighter jets that don't work that our airmen need. And I say enough. And what do we get because of this? We get crazed gunmen going to a Florida nightclub, killing 49 and wounding dozens because he doesn't like the fact they're gay. Or a crazy in Georgia burning down a Taco Bell because he didn't have enough meat in his chalupa. Or another nutcase in Texas threatening the cashier to kill her because he didn't like his milkshake. Tell your legislators to fund programs for mentally ill and the homeless, because many of those are mentally ill because they don't get the treatment they so desperately need. And this is the guy from Pittsburgh, George Senda, saying have a great day and I'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay, and you can catch George's videos at coasttocoastam.com. It's up there on the highlight reel right now. Middle America, just saying it the way he sees it. What else is going on the way he sees it? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter, what do you have?
Oh, I couldn't have said it better than what George just said. What a wonderful comment on the social condition of the country. Well, I have a couple administrative points I'd like to start with, a few really interesting reports. Then I'd like to close with a couple comments about 4th of July sightings.
Sure.
But first order of business, George, I'd like to give a well-deserved shout-out to JL over in Butte, Montana, who for the last couple years, maybe 3 years now, has been extraordinarily supportive of our work at the National UFO Reporting Center, and he's been so generous, I just feel it deserves a special comment on the air. He's done a great job in support of our operations, and I'm grateful for it. Second comment, second administrative point, tonight is the 108th anniversary of a very special event that occurred over all of Europe back in 1908. It was a result, of course, of the great explosion out over Siberia. That occurred at 7:17 a.m. local time on the 30th of June, 1908, and it created such meteorological and atmospheric upset that 108 years ago, all of the major cities all across Europe did not even turn on their gas lanterns. The light radiating from the sky was very bright, and they didn't need artificial illumination. Very interesting incident. The Russians call it the Tunguskaya Katastrofa, the Tunguska catastrophe. They don't refer to it as a meteor, and I tend to agree with them. Well, a few reports. Thursday of last week, the 23rd, a gentleman was driving on Interstate 10 near Katy, Texas, very close to Houston. His attention was drawn to an extremely bright object at about 6:20 in the morning, or in the evening. He was driving home from work. It was so bright that he couldn't look at it, George. Under those circumstances, I usually assume that it's just an airliner hovering, or not hovering, but flying in the sky in the distance. But this object hovered for well over a minute, the gentleman estimates. Very interesting sighting. And I mention it in part two because something very similar was seen over Portland, Maine the next day. Gentleman driving on Washington Avenue in Portland, Maine, he saw a cylinder streak across the sky, covered about 60 degrees of the sky in about 1 or 2 seconds, he estimates. Very interesting sighting. The next, or later that night, the 24th of June, again, I think that's Saturday night, her attention was drawn by the fact that all the houses in her neighborhood lost power. Their lights went out. She walked to the back of her house to see if a neighboring community had also lost power. That's when she saw a blimp-shaped object with a very bright light at one end, totally dark at the other, slowly moving along the high-tension power lines that run very close to their property. Talk about an EMP crisis. Boy, it's not just our military adversaries that could cause us some troubles if they decide to do so. The next day, the 25th, very interesting sighting in Salt Lake City that lasted for an hour.
That's huge. That's a long time.
A very long time. Under those circumstances, George, I usually just assume that the object is a high-altitude helium-filled scientific balloon or a balloon with a scientific package. But I've received so many reports from neighboring states, and people assure me that they're accustomed to balloons and these were not balloons, that I tend to believe that they may not be after all. And finally, a report from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, one of these long-duration sightings, and I mention it because that's a very unusual place for scientists to be launching scientific packages. People looked at it with fairly good telescopes. They swear that it was not a balloon. It was something else. They saw a disc shape to it, and don't know what it was, but if there's anybody in the San Francisco area, most of all Redwood City, Palo Alto, and San Jose, please submit a report as to what you saw. Finally, 4th of July, it's usually a very big day for UFO sightings, and they're not fireworks. I'd encourage the Coast listeners, if you go to a fireworks display, please be sure to take a good camera. You're probably going to see something very unusual, and please submit a written report if you see something that clearly is not fireworks. And last point I'd like to make, for those people who are predisposed to use firecrackers, please keep them away from pets. I once had a wonderful dog ruined by firecrackers. They can be really harmful. Have a good 4th, George, and the same to the Coast listeners.
Thank you, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
You know, when Captain Kirk first uttered those words on September 8th, 1966, no one knew the immense impact Star Trek would have on the world. In the five decades since its airing, the original show has spawned five television series spinoffs and a dozen feature films, with Star Trek Beyond from Paramount Pictures arriving, of course, this month. It's an amazing story. Up next, Edward Gross joins us as we talk about the 50-year mission right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Edward Gross with us has an extensive history of covering film and television as a member of the editorial staff of a wide variety of magazines. Now he has written numerous nonfiction books and has been hailed as the world's foremost Trekspert by the Los Angeles Times. He's also a writer-producer of the beloved romantic comedy Free Enterprise that stars William Shatner and Eric McCormick, and his latest book, The 50-Year Mission, the first 25 years that he wrote with Mark Altman as well. Exciting book, Edward, and welcome to the program.
Thanks, George. Thanks for having me.
Boy, when I listen to that Star Trek music, it still gives me shivers. I mean, it was just so cool to hear, wasn't it?
It was. I'm sitting here listening to it as you're playing it. It's just like, oh, my God, here we go again, and it's wonderful. All these years later, and it's still doing it.
When Gene Roddenberry came up with the concept, did he even think it would go this far?
I don't think anybody did. I mean, you know, these are guys who were just putting together a TV show, trying to work, trying to maybe illuminate the human condition a little bit along the way. But this was a show that struggled to stay on the air for 3 years. I mean, year to year, it was a struggle just to keep the thing going. So I can't imagine anybody in front of the camera, behind the camera, thinking that, hey, 50 years from now, we're still going to be talking about this thing.
Well, you know, you're right. And Hollywood is strange. Initially, when emerging writers and producers put together shows, they want to pitch them. They want them bought by the networks, and they're hoping for a little longevity so they can have a nice little income stream coming in. I guess they really never think that far down the line that it could be a huge type of project that would just have legs and live forever.
Well, there's no reason they should, especially back then. Now, of course, everything's a franchise, right? You create
everything. That's
right. Of it being a franchise.
Yeah.
But back then, I mean, with the exception of maybe I Love Lucy, which the reruns just, you know, never died, it was something that nobody could ever expect because it was unprecedented at the time.
By the way, I want people to know how big this book is. I'm in St. Louis right now in my cave studio. I'm going to drop the book on the top of my desk, and they will hear it, and then we'll talk about it. You ready? Here we go.
In New York, George.
That is your book. How long did it take you to write this thing with Mark Altman?
Well, I mean, Mark always says it could be a good doorstop if you don't like the book itself. But it's really, Mark and I, as journalists, started covering the franchise like back in the 80s. So in a sense, this thing's been in the works for over 30 years. Because we've been doing interviews on Star Trek and speaking to people through all the, you know, incarnations that came. You know, we started with the classic series and worked our way through Next Generation and forward. So I think it took us about 2 years to, you know, cull everything together and then conduct all the new interviews. And there are hundreds of interviews in this book that have been brought together. So I'd say 2 years of solid work on pulling together the book.
Did you have fun writing it?
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of fun. You know, when we sat down to write the book, we had the idea of creating the definitive look at the history of Star Trek. That's sort of what our goal was. And as we watched it come together, we realized we thought, at least in our minds, we've achieved that goal. Now, whether or not other people agree with us, we'll see. But that was very satisfying, very exciting to feel it just coming together the way it did, because it's two volumes. Second volume coming out in August.
Well, good for you. Well, we'll get you back on again.
Well, good. We'll
yeah. Hey, by the way, I got to tell you, what a tragedy 12 days ago, when we heard about the death of Anton Yelchin, a Chekhov of a couple Star Trek films, 27 years old, he dies when his Jeep, I guess, comes out of gear and backs up onto him and crushes him next to his brick mailbox and fence. Unbelievable.
Horrible. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to him the Thursday afternoon before he died.
Actually. No.
Yeah, I did an interview with him. It's probably one of his last interviews, I guess. And it was just, you know, I was shocked. I mean, I just couldn't believe it because it's like one of those things, like, I just spoke to him on Thursday. How is this?
Oh, was he headed for superstardom if he had kept up with the franchise?
I don't think, with or without the franchise, he's kind of an acclaimed actor anyway, you know, for independent films and TV and stuff. So I think, I don't think Star Trek necessarily would have, catapulted him to superstardom. But he was a very respected actor already, so I could only imagine things would have gotten better for him.
Edward, we're really close friends with Billy Mumy, who, of course, was in a couple Twilight Zone episodes, but also in Lost in Space, Will Robinson. And
Danger.
That was that era when these science fiction shows started popping up. TV seems to go in streaks. And in that era, science fiction was one of the streaks, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but it was very different. I mean, if you look at what science fiction was like in the early 60s, like up to the point where Star Trek debuted in 66, you know, really, we had the Jetsons in 62. We had The Outer Limits, a classic, of course, in 63, and My Favorite Martian the same year. Lost in Space was a year before Star Trek in 65. And the year that Star Trek debuted, there was The Time Tunnel, also from Irwin Allen, who did Lost in Space, and a sitcom from the creator of Gilligan's Island, Sherwood Schwartz, called It's About Time, about astronauts who go back to prehistoric times and have wacky adventures with cavemen. Science fiction, though, with the exception of The Outer Limits at that time, was either designated for kids or was comedy. It was never treated as a serious form until Star Trek came along.
And then did it come along? And then that had an offshoot for Leonard Nimoy, by the way, because he started doing In Search Of. Remember that show?
Oh, sure, in the 70s. Absolutely.
Yeah, he really did. And the characters, I think, really made the original Star Trek series. The Shatners, Nimoy, George Takei, all those people made that show, didn't they?
Well, he really did, and really, the truth is, it was the triumvirate of Kirk, Spock, McCoy, you know, Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly.
Yeah.
The show really, you know, in its middle of its first season, I think, really honed in on those three guys as this is the center of Star Trek. It needs to be the rapport between these three guys at the center of the whole thing. And everybody else, of course, played an important role in that. But it was really those three guys, I think, that made Star Trek.
That's right, every episode. Stay with us, Edward. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about your work, the 50-year mission. Next hour, we'll take some phone calls with you. All you Trekkies can jump in. We'll be back. Well, talking about Here Comes the Sun, William Forstgen will be my special guest in Asheville, North Carolina, talking about EMPs or solar flares from the sun, too. So you better watch out. But come on by. That's August 27th. It's a great event, live stage show event at the Diana Wortham Theater there. Full information, tickets available, going to coasttocoastam.com. You click the highlight there where you see a little picture of me and the guests there. It's a great time. And Tom Danheiser is the executive producer of the event, our producer here. And Tom has a special thing going on out there, I understand. What is going on there?
George, this is kind of cool. Joshua Warren has in his museum a piece of metallic debris that was found near the Roswell crash site. This is so cool. So I had an idea, and I called Josh, and I said, hey, could we display that for people? And he went, whoa. And I kind of talked him into it. However, he told me the only way he'd do it is if I hired armed police officers to guard it.
Wow.
So what we're going to do is we're going to put it in the lobby in a case. The guys are going to guard it. And folks after the show who want to attend the free meet and greet are going to be allowed to come up, touch it, take a picture with it, take a picture with you, Josh, me, whoever they want, and really get a feel for what this thing's like.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, and full information again at coasttocoastam.com. Click the highlight there. You'll see the picture of the Asheville event, and it'll take you straight there. And then just look for it where it says tickets or it's got Tom's name down there, and you click that. But take some time looking at it, but you'll get there. That's August 27th. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Edward Gross as we talk about his work along with Mark Altman, the 50-year mission. It's about Star Trek. If you love Star Trek, you're going to love making phone calls to us next hour as well. We will be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Edward Gross with us as we talk about the 50-year mission. We're talking about Star Trek, of course. And Edward, when you put together the book, what for you has been the most fascinating aspect of the work you did for it?
I think, we cover the whole 50 years between the two. But I think in Volume 1, the thing that was most exciting to me was looking at the period between the end of the TV show in 69 and the premiere of the movie in 79, Star Trek The Motion Picture. Because that period of the 70s was so significant in the history of Star Trek. I mean, everything kind of happened then. You know, that was the period where you had the show in syndication, you know, reruns, breaking records, going up against local newscasts 5 nights a week. Most people remember watching Star Trek. I watch it 5 nights a week at 6 o'clock. the conventions launched. There was an animated series. There were attempts at bringing Star Trek back. All of those things have become footnotes in history. And what was exciting for both Mark and myself was the ability to take those footnotes and expand each of them, to speak to the people who are involved in those different aspects and sort of chronicle that history in a way that I don't think it's ever been chronicled before.
I had William Shatner on the show a couple of years ago, and just a delightful guy. We had fun on the program. But I always heard he was a toughie when they were filming and putting together Star Trek for the TV show.
Well, I think, he was, the thing people have to remember is that William Shatner was hired as the star of Star Trek, right? I mean, this was a star vehicle. This was not an ensemble show. I mean, some of the cast members years later would say, well, Star Trek in the beginning was an ensemble show. It never was. It was a William Shatner starring vehicle. And then all of a sudden, this fellow named Leonard Nimoy, the guy with the pointed ears, started getting all the media attention. And he started getting all the mail. And that triggered, I think, I don't know if it's jealousy is the right word, but it triggered something in Shatner. And it created a real problem on the set because Nimoy would, I think the Saturday Evening Post or a magazine back at the time did a profile of Nimoy saying that without Nimoy there would be no Star Trek.
Wow.
And apparently, according to one of the writers, nobody was near Shatner for days because of that. It's very tough when you're the leading man and suddenly you're
and you get that. That's right.
Yeah, is suddenly as least as popular as you, if not more, more popular.
Well, but what he should have realized, though, that Nimoy was a character. I mean, you know, they had him dressed up with the pointy ears, that little high hand wave, which I still can't do, by the way.
I
cannot separate. No.
You just do it on one.
I can do it with two of my fingers, but the other two, the baby finger and the index finger by it, I can't do it, the ring finger. I can't do it.
Yeah, well, one hand, and like I said, the other one just looks at the other hand and just feels sad.
But he should not have been upset over, over a character. You know, if it was another typical actor who looked human, that'd be different. But, you know, they had Nimoy all dressed up like a little character.
But Nimoy also, I think, took some pleasure in the fact that he was getting this fan mail, this attention. I mean, who wouldn't, right? I mean, you know, it's human nature. But then he started making demands, you know, to sort of match his popularity. And there was a point, I don't know if you know this or not, where they were going to replace Leonard Nimoy for the second.
Really? Because he was that difficult?
Well, yeah. I mean, he was demanding a lot more money than the budget had. I mean, this show was made on a very, very tight budget that got tighter every year. And they had actually hired an actor named Lawrence Montaigne to replace him for the second season as a different Vulcan character. And NBC ultimately put the kibosh on that. They said, no, you cannot do the show without Leonard Nimoy as Spock.
It's amazing what they could do now with computer-generated graphics and images. And in those days, they had to create, make, build all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah. Hey, look, my kids look at the old Star Trek now, especially the original versions without the, you know, enhanced effects they did a few years back.
Yeah.
And they look at it, they just think it looks horrible.
They laugh.
Get beyond those effects, but those were state-of-the-art at the time for television.
Gosh, I remember seeing a Flash Gordon show, and you could see the string carrying the rocket ship, you know?
I had to practically pay my kids to watch the original King Kong, right?
Yeah.
Because it's black and white.
It's black and white, that's right.
And the effects are terrible, according to them. But then they saw it, and they watched the documentary and how they did it without computers and everything, and they fell in love with it.
Now, Star Trek started in color, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the big thing about Star Trek is, like, NBC wanted to, you know, with GE and stuff, they wanted to be, RCA, I guess, at the time, they wanted to show off the color TV. What can be done with color television? That's why there's so much color in Star Trek.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's really a good point. Now, Shatner wrote a book a few years ago himself, didn't he?
Well, he's written a lot of books.
Yeah. But he wrote one about his relationship with Nimoy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it just came out fairly recently, Leonard. I think it came out this year, actually. And it's funny because, you know, he often refers to Nimoy as his brother, you know, that they were siblings, that any problems on the set were the nature of brothers who are arguing with each other, you know. But one of the highlights of the book for us was we unearthed this memo that Gene Roddenberry had written to Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. And he admits in the letter that he shouldn't really be writing this to DeForest Kelly. But it was really taking these two guys on the carpet for their behavior and how they were acting and how they were threatening to destroy Star Trek, in a sense, because it was becoming more about them than it was about the show.
At what point and how many years into it did they start talking about doing a film, a movie?
That started pretty early on. I mean, when the convention started happening in like 72 and 73, the first convention was in January of 72, and you saw the response that people had, you know, Roddenberry started talking about the idea that maybe there is a movie in this. I mean, he came up with one wacky idea. His first idea that we know of was a thing called The Cattleman, and it was about intelligent cows, basically, that were being harvested for food. And, you know, Kirk and company were going to be dealt with this, you know, moral quandary. What do we do about this? They're feeding a people, but they're intelligent. So that was the first version. And then from there, throughout the 70s up to Star Trek the Motion Picture, there were quite a number of attempts to make a movie or, you know, just interest Paramount in a treatment to say, hey, this would make a great movie.
If I recall, the movie wasn't that well received, was it?
No, it wasn't at the time because, you know, it came out in the aftermath of Star Wars. You know, I think the 1-2 punch of Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1977 made Paramount say, you know, we got to get a movie out there. But the problem with the movie, in one way, is that it's got too much of an emphasis on special effects or visual effects that don't really mean anything when you watch the film. You stare and go, what does that mean? It's just a bunch of lights and glowing things, you know, that they're spending 10 minutes going through. But at the same time, it's very interesting in retrospect. The movie is the one Star Trek movie that brought a real sense of scope, a real, and I don't mean action like the J.J. Abrams movies. I mean a sense of being in space, that these are people who are encountering the unknown, and you get the vastness of everything, the size of the Enterprise, and the, and space itself when they're out there.
That was exciting, too.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I was really not a fan of the second generation of Star Trek. Once Shatner left and Nimoy left, I kind of, you know, by that time, what year would that have been? I would have been in my early 20s, I think.
Well, Star Trek The Next Generation launched in 87.
87.
Right. And believe me, in the beginning, nobody wanted.
Well, I was, I don't know, I was in my mid-30s then. But, okay.
Nobody was excited about that idea in the beginning. I mean, the original cast was very outspoken about the fact that, you know, you can't do Star Trek without us, and who can blame them? They were making these movies. Who needed the competition of a TV show? And the fans thought you could never do it without Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and the rest. You just can't do a TV series based on this. But give Next Generation its props. I mean, after a couple of
it did well
rough years. I mean, the first year was really rough.
Well, so was the original.
But Next Gen was really rough.
Really, like almost cancellation rough?
Well, no, it did well in the ratings, so they were pretty secure there. It's just that, you know, Gene Roddenberry was running Next Generation. You know, he'd been bumped to an executive consultant position in the movies after the first one. So he was running Star Trek The Next Generation in that first season, and the problem was he was focusing too much on the past. He was repeating ideas that had been done on the original series. And it was hurting the show in a lot of ways, because it just felt so repetitious. But gradually that changed, and by season three, when Michael Piller joined and started running things in terms of the writers, the show became its own thing.
At what point did the Trekkies start popping up all around the country?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of people who watched the show. You know, they didn't have demographics back when the original series ran. So people, you know, NBC and Paramount, which took, you know, purchased Desilu and ultimately owned Star Trek, had no way of knowing how many people were really watching the show. But there were college students and all, you know, I mean, a ridiculously high audience watching it then. But then when that show went into reruns, when, you know, as I said earlier, they started putting it up against the local newscasts in the evening, people recognized what Star Trek was. And the audience just grew. It's like, you know, word of mouth spread.
Yeah.
And that's why those conventions and everything was a gathering place for those Star Trek fans. And the word spread from there, and it just kept growing. It's really an incredible story when you look back at how this thing came out of nowhere. And, you know, it was the show that for the first time, I think, in history of TV, an audience said, no, we don't accept cancellation. We will not take this. And they fought to get it back, and they got it back.
Ed, tell me about the title, The 50-Year Mission, The First 25 Years.
Well, basically the idea is that this started off as one book. It was going to cover the entire 50-year history. And we went to our publishers and said, you know what, we can't do it. I mean, we can do it, but it's not going to be as effective. Can we split this into two books? And they said yes, and we did. So what we decided a good dividing point was the first 25 years literally goes from 66 to 91. So the premiere of Star Trek, I mean, although the book starts before that, to 91, which was the release of the last film featuring the original cast, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
I mean, if you're into Star Trek, it's a great book to have. I mean, it is just part of everything that's Star Trek. I really think you got to have it.
I hope everyone agrees with you. I'm hoping also, you know, Mark and I, when we wrote the book, our intention was not only to say, okay, this is a great book for Star Trek fans, but hopefully people are interested in the dynamics of what goes on behind the scenes on the making of a TV show or, you know, a movie or a phenomenon, if you want to go that far. We were hoping it would appeal to all of that as well, so it wouldn't be strictly a Star Trek book.
And what do you think of television today, Ed? Because, I mean, there's so many channels now on cable and on satellite. I mean, how do people even find the programs that they watch? My son told me about Breaking Bad.
Right.
You know, I didn't even know what was out there at that time. He said, Dad, you got to start watching these. And it wasn't until it went to Netflix that I watched them all in everything that was available. But with all these channels that are out there right now, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, how do these TV shows make it?
I think it's, you know, a niche audience is what a lot of these shows go for now. If you can get a dedicated niche audience, that's fine, because nobody's going to get a blockbuster rating these days. I mean, the networks still do. Big Bang Theory, for instance, is a show that still draws like 17 million people's good English, 17 million people a week. But these cable shows and these smaller shows now are going for a smaller, dedicated fan base, it seems. So they don't need the same high ratings. But I mean, they just have to know that they have a following, a rabid following for the shows. And if it grows beyond that, that's great. But it's amazing how many shows are on now. You know, I've been a journalist now for 35 years, and I've always prided myself on being very aware of what shows are on and that sort of thing. I have a real good sense of it. Now I hear something's in its third season. I'm like, where did this come from? I never heard of this thing.
Yeah,
before.
I know. It's crazy.
It is crazy. It makes me nuts.
Yeah, I've gotten to know David Black really well. He's a writer from the old Law & Order show.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, who knew that this thing had been on that long?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
It really is. It really is.
Well, back to Star Trek and then the evolution. Tell me about where it's headed today. Where's the franchise going?
Well, I mean, we've got two aspects of the franchise. You've got, you know, the J.J. Abrams-produced movies, with the third one of which, I think you mentioned at the outset of the show, is coming out July 22nd, Star Trek Beyond. Now, those films have injected a life into Star Trek that it desperately needed. I mean, those J.J. Abrams movies take a lot of crap from people. But the truth is, when it started, Star Trek was in its death throes. I mean, Enterprise, you know, was limped off the air, basically. Voyager didn't do much better. The last two Next Generation movies tanked at the box office. They did terrible. And the franchise needed a shot in the arm, and J.J. Abrams gave it to it. You know, it resurrected Star Trek in a lot of ways and grew the audience beyond the typical core that they'd always been satisfied with on the original series films.
Kept it alive.
Huh?
He kept it alive.
Absolutely. I absolutely believe that if J.J. Abrams had not come along, then Star Trek would have gone away for a very long time. And
I think you're right.
Somebody would have said, you know, we should give this thing another shot. But the energy he put into those movies. Now, don't get me wrong. I look at the trailers and everything for Star Trek Beyond, the Rihanna song playing over the trailer. I think it's way too Guardians of the Galaxy, and I'm hoping that the final film will reflect, you know, sort of what Star Trek is. More than, you know, that I'm getting mm-hmm. the impression of so far.
And what do you think with the original Star Trek, what was the main message that Roddenberry wanted people to get?
Well, I think the whole idea was, you know, back then it was such a crazy time with everything that was going on in the 60s.
Oh, my God.
You know, yeah. I mean, just crazy, crazy times. And, you know, other people have said this, so it's hardly an original thought, but when you watch Star Trek, you saw a bridge crew, first of all, consisting of, you know, whites working alongside African-Americans, working alongside Asians, working alongside actual aliens. it was an image at a Russian, let's not forget it, you know.
And it worked.
And it worked. It showed a unity, and it showed a hope for the future that we're going to get beyond all of this craziness someday and achieve, you know, that future. And I think that sense of hope is what, you know, Star Trek gave the audience. And now we've got the new Star Trek coming in 2017, produced by Brian Fuller, new TV series. And I think Brian, who just did Hannibal recently, but got his start on Star Trek Deep Space Nine and Voyager, is going to embrace that same notion of saying, okay, where are we as a people, and how are we exploring this through the prism of the future?
Are any of the original cast members going to be in the new TV series?
There's been very little information that's come out, but I would imagine, from the, you know, from what I've heard so far, is that they're going to try to carve out their own piece of the universe.
Their own niche.
You know,
okay.
And I think maybe, you know, at some point, maybe somebody will appear, but I think they're going to have to establish themselves, and that this show is going to embrace modern storytelling.
I think they have to have a walk-on by Captain Kirk. Or
Oh, eventually, you know, I'm sure. But
or are they going to give that name to a younger person in the new series?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the idea is this is set, supposedly set in the universe, not the J.J. universe, which just recently got called the Kelvin universe, just so you know. but It's supposed to take place in different periods throughout what they call the Prime Universe, the regular Star Trek universe. So whether they go to a young Kirk and that sort of thing, they might at some point, but I think initially they're going to strike out on their own.
All right, when we come back, a final hour to go with Edward Gross. We're going to take your phone calls. If you're into Star Trek or sci-fi, check in with us. We're talking about his book, The 50-Year Mission, and right underneath it, it says The First 25 Years. So let's have some fun next hour. Ed Gross with us, and your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.